This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Italian police have arrested two Afghan nationals, one accused of plotting attacks in Italy, the UK and France, and a second has been arrested for alleged people trafficking.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome reporting on an investigation of an alleged terror cell. Details next.
Also here in Washington, a congressional panel held hearings today on terrorism in sub-Saharan Africa. And Cameroon closes border markets in the north because of a rash of attempted suicide bombings in the past week.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Italian police have arrested two people suspected of being part of a terror cell planning attacks on European cities. Warrants have been issued for at least three others. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments. From Rome, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Italian police have arrested two Afghan nationals, one accused of plotting attacks in Italy, the UK and France, and a second has been arrested for alleged people trafficking. Police are also looking for three others, two Afghan nationals and one is a Pakistani. All five are alleged to have belonged to a terror cell with links to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Now, while one of the prosecutors said there was no evidence of an imminent attack, police said this cell was preparing to make some kind of attack in Italy and had photographs and video images in the cell phones that were confiscated of particular sites, including the Colosseum. There were also images of the Port of London and some images and video of the port area and the departures area of Bari Airport. That's the town of Bari where the arrests took place on the east coast of Italy.
Josephine, any idea how this investigation began in Italy?
Well, it seems that the inquiries began last December after four Afghans were spotted filming video inside a shopping center in Bari in southern Italy. And one of the prosecutors said it was clear that these were not tourist images. And he said, even though we don't want everyone to think that anybody seen filming a video or taking pictures is a suspect in some way, he said they appeared to have been scouting sensitive sites, and a police search of their phones uncovered these images of the city's airport and port, as well as key sites in Rome and London.
Do we know whether those arrested were in Italy legally?
They appear to have come in as migrants. At least one of them was staying at a migrant center in Bari. And that, of course, is very controversial. Bari is a port city. Many ferries and ships leave from Bari for other points in the Mediterranean, including Greece. And there's concern that Bari is a transition point. And even though the Interior Minister, Angelino Alfano, praised what he called this high-level investigation, saying that it was a sign that Italy's anti-terrorism laws were functioning and that the security of Italians was a government priority. There were very strong words today from Matteo Salvini. He's the head of the anti-immigrant Northern League party. He accused the government of being complicit and said, how many human bombs are being allowed to enter the country and do we have to wait for an attack to control the border and limit the number of people entering? So you can see this is a very divisive debate. And the Islamic community was very concerned to see that there was no trial by media as this investigation continues.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna from Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Here in Washington, a congressional panel held hearings today on terrorism in sub-Saharan Africa and whether it is destabilizing some countries. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee took testimony on the threat from such groups as Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and others. The groups are responsible for thousands of killings and abductions and the displacements of millions of people. The committee chairman said poor governance and corruption have played a role in the rise of militant groups. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, was the lead witness. She said, despite positive developments on the continent, instability and conflict persist in parts of Africa.
This instability has a direct bearing on U.S. national interests and those of our closest allies. Terrorists, narcotic traffickers, and a range of transnational criminal organizations exploit state fragility and conflict. Conflict destabilizes states and borders, it stifles economic growth, and it robs young Africans of the opportunity for education and a better life.
Thomas Greenfield said, while terrorist attacks can occur anywhere, Africa has certain vulnerabilities that must be addressed.
Therefore, we're working with our African partners to increase their abilities to prevent and respond to such threats and to address the conditions that perpetrate the cycles of instability and conflict across the continent. Addressing instability in Africa requires a comprehensive and a balanced approach, as you have stated. We cannot focus solely on the security aspects of the solution. Military, intelligence, and law enforcement tools are vital to defend a range of threats, but they cannot replace robust diplomacy and the hard work required to strengthen democratic institutions, to stimulate economic growth, trade and investment, and promote development, education, and broad-based economic opportunity. The State Department, USAID, and the Department of Defense, known as the 3Ds, and several other agencies offer unique expertise and capabilities, and it is essential that each organization has the tools to contribute to our common objectives of building immediate and long-term stability in Africa.
The State Department official outlined what needs to be done to strengthen democratic institutions in Africa.
Stability begins with building strong and stable democratic processes. Addressing individual and collective grievances created by lack of governmental accountability, corruption, denial of basic human rights, and feelings of political inclusion is not just the right thing for governments and civic leaders to do. It is a security imperative. Stability in Africa ultimately requires leaders with the will and the capacity to respond to the needs and aspirations of their people.
Thomas Greenfield said the U.S. remains focused on free and fair elections in Africa. She adds the civil society and a free press must be empowered. The courts must uphold the law and security forces must respect human rights.
The Associated Press reports Greek police fired tear gas to break up a fight among 300 migrants and refugees stranded at the Greece-Macedonian border. Police say they do not know why the fight broke out between Afghans and Pakistanis at the makeshift camp at Idomeni. They say sticks, stones, and iron bars were used as weapons. The camp holds about 10,000 people. Greek authorities are trying to gradually evacuate the camp and move the refugees elsewhere. They've been stranded there for months after Macedonia closed its border, blocking the Balkans' route into Europe. There are about 54,000 migrants and refugees in Greece. Meanwhile, in Turkey, a rights group says border guards are shooting and beating some Syrian refugees trying to enter the country. Human Rights Watch says during March and April, Turkish border guards killed five people, including a child, and seriously injured 14 others. It's calling on the government to investigate excessive force by the border guards.
K Cameroon has closed border markets in the north because of a rash of attempted suicide bombings in the past week. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the border town of Makari, where officials say local self-defense groups have been essential in preventing civilian casualties.
42-year-old Alaji Damna is head of the local self-defense group in the northern border town of Makari. He tells soldiers that he is having trouble hearing after a loud explosion in a mosque during early morning prayers Monday. Muslim cleric Buba Garba says no one was killed.
Le neuvième personne, c'était le petit qui est venu avec le kamikaze. Ils sont finis de prier.
He says vigilantes killed with a bow and poisoned arrow a young man they were seeing for the first time in their mosque. He says the man was shot when he moved towards the imam, shouting that he should pray for peace in the world. He says the man's explosive vest detonated while vigilantes were using a long stick to search him from a distance. The self-defense groups have been working in close collaboration with soldiers from Cameroon's Rapid Intervention Battalion. Njok Isaac, one of the senior military health personnel based in the town of Mora, says the military treated people wounded in the mosque attack.
Sur 24 heures, nous passons 18 heures avec elle dans les villages. Nous sommes vraiment actifs.
He says the soldiers make sure they spend at least 18 hours with vigilantes every day. He says they have been asked by their hierarchy to take care of their health needs and share the food they have with them. Governor of the Far North region, Mijiyawa Bakari, says at least 12 suicide bombers have tried to carry out attacks in the past week. He says he is happy that there were no casualties, and he is, on behalf of the government and people of Cameroon, congratulating the self-defense groups who for the past 3 months have stopped hundreds of suicide bombers from killing innocent citizens. He says the suicide bombers are crossing over from Nigeria, and 3 women in their 40s were among the would-be bombers killed in the past week. He says it appears Boko Haram is no longer using young girls. The governor said Cameroon is investigating whether these female suicide bombers are among the hundreds of Cameroonian women who have been abducted by Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Makari, Cameroon.
Kenya said last week that it will close 2 huge refugee camps, citing security reasons for the decision. Some analysts agree there is a security threat, while others say different motives are at play. Nevertheless, they say that the rights of refugees need to be considered. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
The Kenyan government has announced it will close its refugee camps in Dadaab and Kakuma, which collectively house more than 500,000 refugees. Dadaab is considered the largest refugee camp in the world, hosting more than 328,000 refugees, most of them Somalis escaping conflict in their country. The government has cited national security amid terrorist threats as the reason for the closures. Human Rights Watch senior refugee researcher Jerry Simpson says that refugees are not the source of such threats in Kenya.
There's not a single shred of evidence that any registered Somali refugees in Kenya have been behind any attacks in Kenya. So far, not a single Somali refugee has been charged with or convicted of any such offences. In the case of the Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi and the Risa attack in northeast Kenya last year, Somali nationals have been charged with those offences, but they are known to have come in directly from Somalia and were not registered refugees.
Ministry of the Interior spokesman Mwenda Njoka disagrees, saying that terrorists have used the camps to plan and train for attacks, like the one at Nairobi's Westgate Mall, where 67 people were killed in September 2013.
I will tell you, for a fact, like the people who carried out the terror attack, the Westgate, several of them were traced either through phone calls or through various contacts, intelligence, to refugee camps in Dadaab.
Governance and security expert Mumo Nzau agrees that the camps pose a security threat, but argues that a measured approach needs to be taken.
They have been infiltrated by terrorists, but it is not to the scale that every other refugee is a terrorist. And therefore, it is important that a lot of consultation and care is taken so that innocent people don't get hurt in this process.
And one solution, Nzau believes, is to relocate the camps.
They can move them right inside Somalia, but in a way that it is safe for them and that they can be accessed by the international refugee agencies and other aid agencies.
Kenya, which has been hosting refugees for nearly 25 years, has previously threatened to close the camps, most recently in 2013 and again last year, but did not follow through. Kenya's elections are set for next year, and HRW Simpson says that politicians like to bring up the refugee issue around such cycles.
So we hope that this is just hot air ahead of those elections, but it remains to be seen.
Njoka denies that elections have anything to do with the timing of this announcement. Regardless of electoral considerations, aid workers like Lisbeth Albrecht, Kenya's head of mission for Doctors Without Borders, want the government to keep the camps open in the interests of the refugees.
Well, we definitely hope that we'll reconsider the call.
The Kenyan government says the voluntary repatriation process, which was specified in a 2013 agreement signed by the Kenyan and Somali governments, as well as the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, has been slow. The government announced it has already disbanded the Department of Refugee Affairs. It is unclear when or if the camp closures will begin. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Two former Rwandan mayors went on trial in Paris today for their alleged role in the killing of about 2,000 ethnic Tutsi during the 1994 genocide. Titi Barihirwa and Octavian Ngezi are accused of crimes against humanity for allegedly inciting and taking part in the deaths of civilians who sought safe haven in a church in the Kabarondo in eastern Rwanda. The accused have denied any involvement in the killings. They have been held by French authorities for several years after being arrested in French territory. If found guilty, they face possible life sentences. They were tried in absentia by a Rwandan court and found guilty.
Twenty-two minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A visit to the birthplace of his grandmother in Ethiopia inspired an engineer to tackle the energy challenges faced by rural farmers. Hizkias Dufera is founder and CEO of Dufsar Energy, LLC. The company develops innovative renewable energy-based products. Through cooperation with Ethiopia's Ministry of Water and Energy and an agreement with the Oromia Coffee Farmer Cooperative, Hizkias company installed 20,000 solar power systems for farmers in the Oromia region. The agreement provides for developing solar power for as many as 1.4 million people across the region in Ethiopia. I spoke with Hizkias about his inspiration for solar energy and how it's transforming the lives of people living in rural areas.
The project started actually when I went to visit my grandmother in Ethiopia in 2011. That's when I saw the need for significant energy problems, specifically in the rural areas. I came back and actually started developing the product here in the U.S. My background is electrical engineering. And we showed it to the people in the village, and people were extremely excited about it. They wouldn't let us go. They wanted the product right then. That's when we said, all right, this is a major problem that we can actually resolve. And we started a pilot in June or July of 2013. And we've been testing the product in the field. And we've gotten really good results with no issues whatsoever.
So what was the actual insight that prompted you to say, this is what I need to do?
Africa usually has a lot of sun. In Ethiopia, for instance, it's called 13 months of sunshine. One thing that's available throughout the year is, you know, the sunlight. And I work in renewable energy here in the U.S. at the time. So the application for developing something that is solar powered, but the challenges are, so the sun is only available during the day, but most of your energy needs is at night or in the morning when you wake up. So we had to devise something that stores the energy from the sun, like a battery system. We also developed the light. So we have designed an LED light, energy storage system that stores the energy from the sun, and then the panel, the solar panel that gets mounted on the roof.
How accessible is it for people in rural areas to get it? You mentioned earlier that someone had it in their home. So how do they get it, and what is the cost of it?
It's currently being sold right now in Ethiopia, and we will be launching in Ghana next month. The way they will get it is we have an office in Addis Ababa, the capital city of Ethiopia. That's where our products are stored. And we work with the local communities, whether are farmer cooperatives or development agencies. Through them, they register, and then we will be able to provide it for them. The product costs about $400. For people who are interested in purchasing, we can provide them information as to where to get it. Right now, it's available in two countries, in Ghana and Ethiopia, and we expect to expand to other African countries very soon.
If I'm understanding correctly, you're saying that mostly farmers are using this, and how are they able to afford this? It sounds like it's really expensive.
One of the things that we have done is actually design a product that lasts a very long time. We provide five-year warranty, and a product lasts more than 10 years. So what development associations or the farmer cooperatives have been able to do is provide financing. In Ethiopia, the farmer cooperatives, the way it works is they actually sell the produce that the farmers have to the market. So they provide access to the market for the farmers. So the co-op has funds that comes from the farmers. So essentially, they would promote it, and for farmers who are interested, they would finance it over 3 years, which makes it very affordable.
Someone who has a mobile phone, they are able to charge their mobile phone using the solar device.
Correct.
And how long does it take to charge the phone?
It depends on the phone, but we have a fast charging system. Like if it's a small phone, it will charge in less than an hour. But if it's one of the larger smartphones, it may take an hour and a half to charge one phone. People can charge up to 8 phones simultaneously. And that's why we have seen really significant interest on the business side of it, because, you know, mobile phone penetration in Africa is pretty significant right now.
That was his Kaius Dufera, founder and CEO of Dufsar Energy, LLC. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of New Jersey. And for more information about the solar energy company, you can visit their website at www.dufsar.com.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Brotte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.